the headlines. At least 46 Palestinians are injured during an Israeli attack on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Russia says Ukraine launched a major drone attack in Moscow, but its air defenses intercepted all eight of the unmanned aircraft. And South Korea says it's working closely with the U.S. for a possible provocation by North Korea with its planned launch of a reconnaissance satellite. Thanks for joining us. Israeli forces have injured at least 46 Palestinians in their latest raid on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The regime's military stormed the Ascab refugee camp in the raid. The main target was the homes of two Palestinians who were shot dead by Israeli forces earlier this month, allegedly over anti-Israel operations. The troopers fired tear gas and rubber-coated bullets to disperse local Palestinians who confronted them, leading to injuries. Nablus has seen intensified crackdown by the regime's military over the past weeks. That is against the backdrop of almost daily Israeli raids across the West Bank. The correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier to give us more on the latest Israeli raid on the West Bank city of Nablus.
This time, Israeli forces raided the refugee camp of Asqar East Nablus in order to map the homes of two Palestinian martyrs in the Asqar refugee camp. The first one, Hassan Qabdani, he was killed after the Israeli military accused him that he was responsible for the shooting that led to the killing of three settlers in the occupied West Bank, as well as the home. The Israeli forces took the measurement of the home of Hussam Salim, another Palestinian martyr, and the Israelis accuse him for being responsible, who gave the orders for the killing of one of Israeli soldiers last year, also in the occupied West Bank. During this operation to map the homes of the two Palestinian martyrs, clashes took place between the Israeli forces and Palestinian residents of the Asqar refugee camp. And we have to mention that, of course, Palestinian fighters live inside the Asqar refugee camp, of course, or they came from other areas and they clashed with Israeli forces because the Israeli military claimed that they came under fire. The Palestinian Ministry of Health said at least 46 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces during the operation to Asqar refugee camp.
Palestinians have held a funeral for a man that was killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. We have discussed the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. Palestinians hold a funeral for a man killed by Israeli forces during a raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. 37-year-old Ashraf Mohammed Ibrahim was shot while confronting the storming of Jenin by occupation forces. Another Palestinian succumbed to his injuries sustained in an Israeli raid in Al-Khalil 2 days ago. And earlier today, regime forces also raided a village near Ramallah, wounding two more Palestinians there. The regime has intensified its crackdown across the occupied territories in recent months. Nearly 150 Palestinians have lost their lives in Israeli attacks in the West Bank so far this year. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. First, Mona Kandil out of Ramallah, and Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadoun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Vancouver. Thank you both for being with us. Well, Mona, can you fill us in on the latest and what has taken place today?
We have to mention that Ibrahim spent 11 years behind bars, and then he was released. He was an officer of the Palestinian Security Forces, according to the Palestinian Authority. It's not clear whether Ibrahim engaged in direct clashes with the Israeli forces or not. However, the Israeli military issued a statement saying that its troops came under fire during the raid to Jenin City, and that they wounded 8 Palestinians. One of them was in serious condition. 6 others were arrested by the Israeli forces in Jenin. The Israeli soldiers seized with them from Jenin the weapons and other military equipment.
Thank you, Mona. Well, Charlotte, I mean, already the Palestinians basically are living in this hell that Israel has created. And now it's hell on top of hell as they exacerbate these attacks. What's going on? Why do we see the regime? I mean, on a daily basis, unfortunately, we're reporting about more and more Palestinians being killed. Why are we seeing this at this time?
Unfortunately, I mean, the Zionist regime, since its inception in 1948 and before, has always followed a policy of attempting to eliminate the Palestinian people from the land of Palestine by all means, including, you know, by direct force and violence, through extrajudicial killings, through the confiscation of land, the demolition of houses, and all of that for over 75 years has failed to break the resistance of the Palestinian people. But what we also see is that whenever there is a growth in resistance, the Zionist regime is dedicated to wipe that out. It wants to just absolutely suppress Palestinians from struggling for their freedom and struggling for their liberation and struggling even for their most basic rights. And so in an attempt to crush that resistance, we see these brutal raids taking place night after night, the invasion of houses, the explosion of doors from people's homes, the demolishing of homes that are owned by entire families in order to impose collective punishment on a Palestinian prisoner. All of this is an attempt to erase and suppress the resistance of the Palestinian people that the Zionist regime has been unable to do for 75 years.
What about that, Mona? Your assessment, you're on the ground there. Are you seeing actually the resistance picking up energy, or do you see intimidation of the resistance? Your overall assessment of what Israel is trying to do and the reality of what's on the ground.
Well, in the last few years, let's say the last 2 years, a number of Palestinian newly formed resistance groups had been active in several areas across the occupied West Bank. In Jenin, there was the Jenin Brigade, in Nablus, the Lion's Den, in Ariha also, Ariha's Brigade. So these newly formed Palestinian resistance groups have proved every day, or continue to prove, that all its members are young Palestinians who were not affiliated in any of the Palestinian well-known resistance groups like the Hamas movement, Jihad, or Fatah, or even the leftist wings here in the occupied West Bank. Despite the fact that the Israelis continue to raid Palestinian areas on a daily basis, all these Israeli measures did not succeed to intimidate the Palestinians. However, Palestinians today are even more determined, are united to continue resisting the Israeli forces, even if more people are being killed, others are being arrested, their homes are being destroyed, and their lands are being confiscated. But at the end of the day, nothing would bring them to their knees, and they would continue to fight the Israeli soldiers.
Well, thank you both for being with me on this news review. Mona Kandu out of Ramallah, Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Vancouver.
Head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting has called on cultural assemblies of the resistance front to launch a new movement to portray various dimensions of Palestinian resistance against the Zionist regime. Peyman Jabeli made the proposal while meeting with the leader of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad resistance movement, Ziad al-Nahala, in Lebanon. The IRIB chief highlighted the recent heroic victories of the Palestinian people that he believes expose the increasing vulnerability of the Israeli regime. Al-Nakhalah, for his part, said the resistance has changed the equations on the ground in its favor, shattering Israel's dream of being a superhero in the region.
RIIB chief, Iran's national broadcaster, Piman Jabali, is on an official visit to Lebanon, where he has met top officials. A meeting with Lebanon's culture minister was seen by both figures as significant in order to boost bilateral cooperation on all levels, especially in the cultural sector.
As we had together faced the threat of military war, we together must face together in collaboration this cultural war, this war that intends to distract our awareness of what in real is happening in the region.
The highlight of the trip was a tour to towns in southern Lebanon. Head of the IRIB told reporters as he overlooked occupied Palestine that the resistance has recorded a historic achievement after inflicting the heaviest defeat on the Israeli regime when it was forced to withdraw from Lebanon. But this victory is something that needs to be honored and protected by the media.
We, the media, with our role to narrate these stories of heroic stances, victories, and highlight the significance of what occurred, have a huge responsibility. A military operation would be limited in space and time, but the job of the media needs to persist in all places and at all times. My presence here as head of the IRIB, and in this town of Marun Aras, which overlooks occupied Palestine, is a symbolic and hopefully practical statement of unity and joint efforts with our brothers in the media of resistance.
IRIB CEO told Press TV that this visit is aimed at strengthening the unity and cooperation among media outlets which support the resistance.
As part of the effort to form, as in the military field, the resistant groups could do a coordinated effort and form the coordinated operation rooms. High on agenda was that to form the same unity among the resistance media. So as part of that, he had meetings with high-ranking Lebanese officials and people in the resistance groups.
Mr. Jabali had met earlier with Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah, who discussed some new and bright ideas on ways to cooperate with all resistance media, especially in Lebanon and Palestine. During their meeting, the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting and Hezbollah Secretary General both stressed the need to strengthen other facets of resistance, namely to confront the mass media campaign, which targets the people of the region. Maryam Saleh from Marun Aras, South Lebanon.
Russia and Ukraine have targeted each other with drones as fighting escalates between the two neighbors. One person has been killed and four others injured after multiple Russian UAVs hit the Ukrainian capital. Ukrainian authorities say that it was Russia's third attack on Kiev in the last 24 hours and 17th in May. Moscow's intensified missile and drone strikes on the Ukrainian capital this month after a lull of nearly 2 months, targeting military facilities and supplies. Meanwhile, Russia has confirmed drone attacks by Ukraine on the capital, Moscow. It says all 8 drones have been downed. Kiev has denied any involvement. North Korea says that it will launch its first military reconnaissance satellite in June. The announcement comes despite warnings from Japan on heightened tensions between Pyongyang and Washington's regional allies. Pyongyang says the launch is essential to monitor what it calls the dangerous military movements of the U.S. and its allies. It lashes out at their joint military drills, saying the war games show their reckless ambition for aggression. Washington and Seoul kicked off what they described as their biggest live-fire exercises last week. Meanwhile, the South Korean military has reacted to Pyongyang's plan to launch a satellite. It says the situation is closely being monitored by Seoul and Washington.
South Korea and the U.S. intelligence authorities are closely monitoring related movements in close cooperation and monitoring a possible provocation of the so-called satellites claimed by North Korea.
North Korea earlier informed Japan of its planned launch. It sparked warnings from Japanese officials who said any North Korean missile entering the country's territory would be destroyed. The notification also prompted Japan to put its ballistic missile defenses on alert. Tokyo believes Pyongyang wants to disguise a missile launch as a satellite. North Korea has recently test-fired a series of missiles. It says the launches are in response to the military muscle flexing by the South and the U.S. The U.S. says China has turned down its request for a meeting between the two countries' defense ministers this weekend. The Pentagon claimed the purpose of the meeting was to ensure that competition between the two countries does not turn into conflict. There is no comment from Beijing yet, but it had earlier told Washington that there was little chance of a meeting as long as the U.S. maintained sanctions on the Chinese defense minister. The sanctions were imposed in 2018 in connection with the Chinese purchase of Russian fighter jets and missiles. Less than 2 weeks ago, U.S. President Joe Biden said that he expected an imminent thaw in bilateral relations, which are at their lowest points in decades. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The United States spent $1.1 trillion of federal discretionary money on militarism in past year. This left less than two-fifths of the discretionary budget for public health, education, environment, and more. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Noted, a staggering majority of the U.S. federal discretionary budget went towards so-called defense and other militaristic and carceral programs in the past year. A new report reveals as U.S. defense spending continues to reach new heights. According to an analysis by the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS, released recently, the U.S. spent $1.1 trillion of the discretionary budget on militarism and war last year, including funding for the Pentagon and law enforcement agencies like the Department of Homeland Security. This amounts to 62% of the $1.8 trillion allotted to discretionary spending in total in fiscal year 2023, a pool of spending that is also meant to fund programs for public health, education, housing, disaster relief, the environment, scientific research, and more. As a result of the huge amount of spending allocated to military and law enforcement, less than $2 of every $5 of the budget was spent on such public programs in fiscal year 2023. Even though the vast majority of the total $1.1 trillion was spent on weapons and the Pentagon, the budget for federal law enforcement alone $31 billion was double the budget for child care and early childhood education last year. Tellingly, IPS found that the U.S. spent 16 times more on weapons and the Pentagon at $920 billion than it did on foreign humanitarian aid and diplomacy. This represents a huge increase in spending on militarism from previous years. According to the analysis, adjusted for inflation, such spending has increased by 94% since 2001. Report author Lindsay Kashagarian, IPS's National Priorities Project Program director, said, "When we invest so heavily in militarism at home and abroad, we deprive our own communities and people of solutions to problems that pose immediate security threats. We underfund programs to end poverty, provide affordable housing, bolster public education, and protect clean air and water at our peril," Kashagarian continued. Spending on militarism takes up the majority of the federal discretionary budget, and it has grown faster than all other spending. If we keep up these patterns, we are hurtling toward a future where we can't afford the basics of a civilized society. These massive increases in spending for initiatives like the increased militarization of the southern border and the failed war on drugs have only led to the U.S. having the highest rate of incarceration in the world, while the U.S. military conquests like its wars in the West Asia region have sapped trillions away from U.S. taxpayers and yielded millions of deaths in the region. Meanwhile, hundreds of billions of this spending goes to private defense contractors, with roughly half of the Pentagon budget going to defense contractors each year. This amounts to tens of billions of dollars of pure profits for corporations like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, who, a former Pentagon official revealed in an interview aired recently, have been intentionally gouging the prices of weapons and equipment in order to make as much profit from federal contracts as possible. But still, Congress continues to fund these militarized programs, the military, homeland security, and federal law enforcement nearly as a matter of faith, the report says. Indeed, Congress increases the amount that the government spends on the Pentagon, the only federal agency that has never passed an audit, nearly every year. This spending is on track to reach a new high for fiscal year 2024, with the White House issuing a record high request for $886 billion in discretionary funding for defense next year, including $842 billion for the Pentagon. For some lawmakers, the U.S.'s absurdly bloated defense budget still isn't enough. In talks over their far-right debt ceiling wish list, Republicans have been saying that they want to push military spending even higher, while also demanding cuts in overall spending for health care and public programs. Meanwhile, National Priorities Project reported, as the United States barrels headlong toward a possible historic debt default, a report published recently highlights that the majority of this year's federal discretionary funds were used for militarized programs, while urging the U.S. government to reprioritize spending to serve human needs instead of the mechanisms and machinery of violence. The report entitled "The Warfare State: How Funding for Militarism Compromises Our Welfare" was published by the Institute for Policy Studies National Priorities Project, NPP, which aims to inspire people and movements to take action to federal resources, prioritize peace, shared prosperity, and economic security for all. Our country's economy faces a dire threat from so-called fiscal conservatives, including the present GOP House majority, who have resorted to dangerous brinksmanship to force deep cuts in the federal discretionary budget, the report states. The report added the discretionary budget contains the Pentagon budget as well as a number of other broadly militarized line items, including nuclear weapons, federal immigration enforcement, law enforcement, prisons, and so on. The paper continues, that same budget also hosts most social programs outside of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. It includes federal jobs programs, education, scientific research, and the like. And this is referring to what critics and even one congressional Republican have called hostage-taking over the debt ceiling.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzi Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has won the presidential runoff election and has now been at the helm for 2 decades, first as prime minister and since 2014 as president. This was a close election and the first time in Turkey's history that there was a runoff. His opposition, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, claims that Erdogan used state funds to get elected, but regardless of how he ran his campaign, he has been re-elected for another 5 years. We will talk about what lies ahead for Turkey as it is facing many challenges and which direction Erdogan will turn to the east or west for his foreign policy priority. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Mahmoud Refat, international relations expert out of Stockholm. Ali Safari, journalist and foreign affairs analyst out of Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start it off in Stockholm with Mahmoud.
after being in power for 20 years, do you see Erdogan changing direction of the way he had governed before because of perhaps not having suitable results, or will he continue on the same path because at the end of the day, he did get reelected?
Well, Erdogan will continue what he started, because Erdogan is very clear today. He is looking for not to be president, but to be replacing to Atatürk, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, in the image of the builder of Turkey. And if the existential presence of the name of Turkey linked to Mustafa Kemal Atatürk and the social regime above all, which he put at that time, which is the secular regime, the way of Erdogan is to make something how to build a new social regime in Turkey. That became very clear. And let's admit he's enough magician in order to succeed to do all these social and radical changes in a society that he received in 2002, 2003, almost 20 years ago, which was very stable on specific rules were put and planted by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. And he changed this construction, which is not easy at all. There were deep state built based on this regime. He could dissolve and dismantle this deep state. There were many institutions, and on top of these institutions, the military, the army, who is armed and carrying and cannot really be taken as easy, this institution, and who tried to make the coup d'etat against them in 2016. All these considerations he could dissolve at and build a new social regime in Turkey. Accordingly, I don't think he will change anything in his way of direction and his way next 5 years, despite I wonder if he continued the 5 years, but that I can talk about that later in another intervention. But for the moment, no. He is building his image as for the history now, with the image of Turkey and with the infrastructure he made for Turkey.
Okay. Well, Ali, what are the main challenges that you think Erdogan will face now?
Well, yeah, I think one of the most important challenges that Erdogan may face with the next presidential term that he will serve is that, as you have mentioned, this was the first time in history that in Turkish presidential election they have experienced a runoff. So it means somehow Erdogan has experienced the danger of falling his government. So he have to, first of all, take some necessary steps, first of all, to prevent falling his power. He may also face with this challenge to somehow find another person in his party. There is some expectation about his son-in-law, Bayraktar, that may take the position of Erdogan in the power in future. So this is, first of all, one of his challenges to secure his position and also power for the next terms. And also one of the most important challenges that he's facing with is the economy. You know, Turkish economy is facing with different challenges, including the lira position as a currency. So also in the field of international relationship, Erdogan also is facing with different challenges with the Western governments and also in the region, including Syria and the affairs between the Karabakh things between the Azerbaijan and Armenia. So I think these are the main challenges that Erdogan is facing with, and he has to also find and implement a strategy to face and cope with them.
Well, Mahmoud, trying to show that he's helping the economy, 5 days before the presidential election, Erdogan raised the salaries of workers by 45%. He also increased pensions and gave discounts on energy bills. Let's talk about the effects of those acts now. I mean, do you think that this will just add to more inflation, or how do you assess those acts?
Well, Erdogan is adopting economic plans that controversial, yes, but until now did not impact Turkey negatively in a serious way, simply because his real plan, I mean economic plan, not the appearing things which we are talking about at in the media, is to have a strong infrastructure inside Turkey. And I think he succeeded so far to make a strong infrastructure, to attract lots of investments from abroad, to build a big military infrastructure, and to sell it outside the drones, which the, Turkey now is almost the number two or three worldwide in selling these, this kind of drones, especially the chemicals drones, which the, and this is why suicide drones and lots of other military equipment. Now Turkey became big exporter for that. So far, I don't think also he will change the existing situation immediately. On the contrary, I think he will continue in that despite the inflation, because this inflation is not threatening the life of Turkish society in a dramatic way. On the contrary, somehow the ability to have money by people, I mean to have credits, to have loans, and to build stores, to build projects, especially small projects, that affecting positively the individuals. That's why the inflation in the society is not that negatively impacting the situation. For this reason, I think President Erdogan will continue his politics. He will not change the politics for the moment, despite the inflation.
Well, what do you think, Ali, because Mahmoud said he doesn't think the inflation is affecting the economy negatively, but we had last year officially inflation peaked at 85%. However, many analysts say the real inflation rate is 105%. I mean, your perspective about Turkey's economy?
Well, it's better to be rational. We are talking about numbers. This is a part of the reality. Turkish economy is suffering from the inflation that you have mentioned correctly. There must be some way to, face with that. We cannot ignore the bad situation of the Turkish economy. This is, as I said, part of the reality. You know, Turkish is suffering from lack of natural resources, and also they have experienced the challenges because of the sanctions that Turkey has experienced in the, past two or three years. So these all things they are affecting the Turkish economy. And when the Turkish economy is, doing so bad like that, like it or not, it's going to, affect the daily life of Turkish people. One of the most, bold thing that the Kılıçdaroğlu was using to target Erdogan was economy. He was asking the people, do you know what is the main reason that you are, war situation, worse economic situation? The main reason of that is because of Erdogan. So we cannot deny that. And also, as I said, we cannot just blame Erdogan for that. I said that Turkey is suffering of some imposed sanction against Turkey. So I think we cannot deny and ignore that. We Erdogan has to find some way in order to secure his power. He has to cope with that and also, as I said, find a solution for the ongoing economic situation of Turkey.
Okay, well, Mahmoud, earlier today, on Monday, the Turkish lira plummeted to a record low after the announcement of Erdogan's re-election. The lira has lost 80% of its value since 2018. Your assessment of all of this, why do you think this happened today with the lira just plummeting like that? And in general, why has the lira lost so much of its value in the last few years?
Well, the fact the lira to lose its value, that's true. It happened. It lost 80% of its value in the last 5 years or 6 years. That because of internal reasons and external reasons. Don't forget the strikes existed against Erdogan, in particular from some Gulf countries just after the coup d'etat in 2016. It started big war on the lira, and we remember how some Gulf countries fired the markets of Turkey at that time. That happened. But Erdogan, again, in my opinion, this gentleman is a real magician, because he can play and manipulate everything and all things. He used this inflation and this liquidity of money, which is not healthy principally in the economic sciences, in the books of economy, we learn this is not healthy for the economy of any state, of any country, and the government with the to put the central bank with principal measure number one is to fight this inflation and to put politics to control the market. But Erdogan, really magician, he used this inflation and this kind of liquidity, existing liquidity of cash in the society, to push banks to give lots of loans to individuals. Like that, individuals became themselves somehow rich and independent, not waiting the government to give them every single thing. They took this money, these individuals, and that which we witness, who visit Turkey, will witness that so much in different regions, not only in Istanbul, but in all regions of Turkey. You will witness that people, normal people, having their own projects, having a store, having a small factory of clothing, for example, having a small food fabrication, things like that, that Erdogan pushed this inflation to be used in that. And meantime, I repeat, Erdogan was feeling safe for the general and the global situation of the Turkish economy because of the infrastructure which he put for this economy. This is not a country, doesn't have any other opportunity to live, or under embargo of dictator regime who is making the military to violate all the economic sectors, like some Arabic countries, for example. No, it's open society where lots of investors come, where this society selling lots of military equipments and non-military equipments, so there is still the economic life and very good life comparing to the non-inflation while the markets should be closed.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, let's switch over to foreign policy side of things. Ali, do you think that Erdogan will implement changes, a different strategy, when we're looking at foreign policy? And if so, what do you think he may change?
Oh, yeah, thank you for that question. You know, in the past 20 years that Erdogan was in power, he wasn't emulating the ways of his predecessor. I mean, the people who was in power before Erdogan. He was trying to just work for the interest of himself and Turkey. Whenever the interest was calling for any decisions, he would do that. You know, when, for example, the interest of Turkey or himself calls for a normalization of relationship with Israel, he would definitely do that. Or, for example, whenever it's the time for attacking Israel, also would do that. So I think based on the experience that we have had from Erdogan in the past 20 years, I think if the some elements of some, I mean, external ones doesn't change, he wouldn't have any kind of changing his policies regarding the, I mean, the regional policies of the war. But one thing is to note that I think some other players may take different decisions with the, for the next presidential term of Erdogan. I think Russia is one of them. Russia, I'm based on my, I mean, the analysis that I have, Russia will not let Turkey to interfere in Karabakh and the clashes between Azerbaijan and Armenia again, because they will not let the balances of power change in favor of Turkey and Azerbaijan more than the current situation. About the Syria, Syria is one of also the most important, I mean, files of international policy of Erdogan. You know, he, one of the members of his campaign promised that Erdogan will meet the Syrian president until the January. And we know that this is one of the conditions that Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president, has made for Erdogan. He will not meet with him until he withdraw all of Turkish troops from the Syrian soil. So right. I think, as I can see, he will not change his policies until some other players, including Iran and Russia, change their strategy towards Erdogan, or maybe put some pressure on him. And as I said, based on our experience, whenever the conditions and the interests of himself demands, he will change his direction.
Well, what do you think about that, Mahmoud? Erdogan, if we look at various approaches, it seems almost kind of schizophrenic in the nature. On the one hand, he shows, as Ali was talking about, for example, on the one hand, he shows that he is anti-Israel, but on the other hand, has relations with Israel. And there's so many other things. When it comes to Syria, I'm going to go back to that. We know that Russia is working on a rapprochement between Turkey and Syria. But as Ali had rightly pointed out about Syrian President Bashar Assad and what he says he wants the Turkish troops to leave Syria before meeting with Erdogan, do you think that's going to happen? Do you think that the Turks are ready to stop its occupation of Syrian territory?
Well, principally, let's start from a political rule, which we teach, or some professors teach to their students of political science or international relations. In international relations, there is no fixed values. There is pragmatism. Somehow Erdogan is following very, very well this rule, which says there is no fixed value or fixed lines in the international relations. In the international relations, there is interest. The language and the major is the interest of the state, number one, and number two, for the regime who is governing this state. Erdogan is much, much more pragmatic than we can think. He played very well with the Israeli card, and this was one of strongest cards he employed at the time of the ship Marmara, in order to wake up the Islam spirit inside the Turkish society at that time. And he succeeded very, very, very well. And at that time, he was adopting a confrontation politics. Today, he adopted, like two years and a half ago, zero problems, and was his first destination to go to and to send his Minister of Foreign Affairs was Israel, in order to open to him the heart of Washington, D.C. He is very, very well knowledgeable of the international relation ground, how this ground is working, how it's functioning. It's not functioning by ethics, the international ground, and never functioned by through ethics or good manners. It has been always working through interests. Secondly, he opened the way at the gate through Qatar with the Egyptian regime, and he started to exchange some economic interests and some conversation, etc. Until he reached the Syrian ground. The Syria for him, for Erdogan, represent 2 points. Number one, the Kurds, who are making, we can say it, headache since a long time for several countries in the region, especially when it comes to the independence of Kurdistan or to the separation of, and this is very normal, by the way, for any nation to be very worried about its integrity and about its land. This is very normal. So this is number one. He wants to attain a big victory in this.
Okay. 30 seconds, Mahmoud, 30 seconds, go ahead.
Yeah, okay, this is number one. And number two, he wants to take prize and very good prize from the international community for returning back the Syrian refugees. By the way, to end this point, Erdogan closed the borders in front of Syrian refugees since 2015, by the way. So there is no ethics in international relations. This is the theory Erdogan adopting.
Okay, at 30 seconds, Ali, final comments.
Well, I think I somehow answer to your questions. I think, first of all, Turkey is not able to continue the occupation forever. They have to leave the territory of other country someday. But this is right that your guest has mentioned. They want to also negotiate on that to take some points from other countries. But in reality, all the project that they have conducted in Syria has failed. They wasn't successful in changing the government there. So the position of Erdogan in Syria is not the good position. Someday they have to make some compromise on that and leave the Syrian territory.
Okay, and on that note, thank you both for being with me. Mahmoud Rafat, international relations expert out of Stockholm. Ali Safari, journalist and foreign affairs analyst out of Tehran. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Brother Sohail is our special guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam, brother. Thank you for having me here.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of the, we can say, occultation of Imam Asr. We know that Imam Asr, Imam Mahdi by the Shias, they believe that he has the power from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So now the question is that if he has the omni power from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, why should he hide from his enemies? And is this being hide necessarily from the hands of the enemies or no, it has other reasons?
So here I would like to talk about knowledge. Mm-hmm. That is in relation to this power. One of the power is knowledge. The knowledge can be divided into two sections.
Okay.
The knowledge of something which is present to us right here and now, the knowledge that is for us, me and you. We can see the mic and the studio and everything. This is called ilm bil hadir, the presence knowledge, the knowledge of the present.
Or ilm huzuri.
Ilm huzuri.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And be the knowledge of something that which we know but is not here now. It's called ilm bil ghaib. Ilm ghaib. The knowledge of what is concealed from the senses. It is. It should be noted, however, that the above division is according to the general linguistic meaning of the term. The knowledge of ghaib itself can be divided into two kinds. The ilm al-ghaib. One, the knowledge that comes to us through our senses but indirectly. Example of the knowledge, of this kind of knowledge that comes through our senses but indirectly are, for example, history.
Yes.
History is one of the knowledge that comes to through our senses, that comes through to us through narrations of from one person to another by speech, in writing, examining the relics and remainings of the past, then deducing certain historical facts from them. This is one kind of ilm ghaib that reaches us. The second one, this type of knowledge of ilm ghaib does not come through our senses. It should be observed that the first type can be by the means of ordinary senses, while the other is not. Well, it's only maybe by special senses which is given to a person, like telepathic sense, if that exists.
Okay.
You see? However, only to the second part of the ilm ghaib, the non-sensory one, that the technical meaning of the knowledge of ghaib is denoted. Ilm al-ghaib that Urf has in mind is the one that is on the second one. The historical mention in the Holy Quran shows about tiding news of the ghaib. So here we would like to say that we have a verse in the Holy Quran that says, nobody knows ilm ghaib apart from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We have in Surah number 6 verse 59 that states, with him are the keys of the ghaib. None knows them but he.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have, who can intercede with him except the cases he permits? He knows what is in front of them and what is behind them, and they encompass nothing in his knowledge to what he wills. Now here we are talking about ilm ghaib mutlaq. You see, this one, apart from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, nobody has it.
Yes.
But Allah has the capacity of giving a part of knowledge of ghaib to someone he likes. You see, a part of it. He can denote that to the prophets and the imams. So, for example, if he wills, he can give that part of ilm ghaib, of which it doesn't become ilm ghaib, because ilm ghaib is a direct construction. It becomes a news.
Mm-hmm.
So Allah has ilm ghaib. He gives that news to the prophets and the imams whenever and wherever they require it. If the imams and the prophet require this kind of knowledge, which is the ghaib of, according to general public, Allah provides them. And because they will, Allah wills. Because whenever prophet requires something to complete their mission, Allah provides it with them, to them. You see? So this is what the knowledge is. Second is to understand, how can they use this knowledge? Can they use in their benefit, or they have to use it in the benefit of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Like, should it be in line with Allah's will or no? Can they use it against it?
Mm-hmm.
No, they cannot use it against
it. Is it only limited to prophets and the imams? I mean, ilm al-ghaib or something?
No. As I said, that Allah wills, he can give it to anyone he likes.
Because we have the story of Asif ibn Barkhiya in the Holy Quran. Because the Surah Naml, ayah 40, referring to Hazrat Sulaiman, that we can say, before you wink or eye, shut an eye, we can say, I can bring it to you. So it shows that a kind of hidden knowledge, hidden ilm is also given to, for example, Hazrat Maryam, the wife of Prophet Ibrahim, the mother of Moses, Hazrat Khiz, Asaf ibn Barkhiya, and the others, isn't it?
Yes. Okay. So we have traditions that it says that one of our imams says that Allah has, or the knowledge is 27 letters, or 29 letters.
Yes.
The knowledge, of which one of that letter, this the one who brought the Bilqis, the throne of Bilqis to Hazrat Sulaiman, had.
Yes.
You see? So that is called ilmu min al-kitab.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Okay.